Hello and welcome back. This is the Metaphysical Podcast, and I'm Victoria Duda from Zenith Lifestyle, bringing you episode 3, The Power of Thoughts and Sentiments. And so far on our journey into the mind, we have established a consciousness-based paradigm, and we have said that we can turn the common assumptions around and say, what if the world is actually based on consciousness, on mind, rather than on matter? And if we work with that assumption, that gives our mind a very, very powerful position. And in fact, if we hear the news today from the world of psychology and esoterics and whatnot, we get the impression that the mind is something mysterious and very powerful. We hear things like we only use 10% of our mind, and that the mind is limitless and we can achieve anything by the power of our thoughts. So I want to go behind these things that we can hear and ask the critical question, what of that is really true? What of that is theoretically true but impossible for us to do in our everyday life? And what is it that is actually possible for us to do? What is it from the power of our mind that we can use? So today, let us be explorers. Let us find out what is real. It might not allow us to explain everything that we find, because I think we are very, very far from being able to explain things that go on our minds and that go on the level of our thoughts and sentiments. But it is less of an importance for me at the moment. For me at the moment, it is much more important to be like an explorer who's going out and explores new realms of reality. And then it might take a long while to find an explanation for what we have seen. So what can the mind really do? What are the facts? The first thing that comes into our mind when we talk about the power of the mind is its remarkable ability to heal the body. And that is something that is commonly known and very widely known as the placebo effect. And I always have to smile a little bit when I hear, you know, materialistic scientists or doctors say something like, oh, but that was only the placebo effect. And I'm very surprised of the little word only, because placebo is nothing but the power of the human mind to actually create healing in the body. And that, to me, is not an only, but it's an exceptional miracle that we should investigate. And how deep that placebo goes, how powerful it can be, we have a lot of examples for that. So in general, we know about the placebo effect, that we might give a sugar pill to someone who believes that that sugar pill is a powerful medication. And then just by the power of the mind alone, the healing effect of the medicament is kicking in. There is actually a really extreme case for that that occurred in the United States in Mississippi with a 26-year-old young man who was left by his girlfriend. And he was so devastated by the loss that he wanted to commit suicide. And for his suicide, he used pills that were very strong medication that he got because he was part of a clinical trial, and he got the pills for free as being one of the people who were trying that out. And he took 29 of these very strong pills, as a result of which he got seriously poisoned and he was close to death. He was quickly rushed into the hospital. Someone found him, and in the hospital they tried to revive him, but he was on the edge of death. And he was showing all the symptoms of serious poisoning leading to clinical death. But it was the same hospital where the clinical trial was held. So they found his file and they looked up exactly what he was given. And that's when they found out that he was one of the people in the control group. So when you test a new medicine, then you always have a control group who don't get any real ingredients, but they get a sugar pill that looks the same as the medicine that they are trying. So it was a placebo. It was not doing anything to the boy. The doctors told him that. They said, you are dying from a sugar pill. And in that moment, when he was told that, the effects stopped and he became okay again. So you can heal yourself with placebo, but this was one of the cases where you almost could kill yourself with the placebo effect. The same effect becomes really interesting when the person involved is actually becoming conscious of what's going on. In other words, they know that they are consciously manipulating their own physiology. There are not so many people, I believe, today alive on the planet who can do that. But we can hear of meditators, shamans, monks, and in modern times, even people working with things like biofeedback, who learn gradually to change their physiology just by the power of their mind. So one of the nearly miraculous achievements that is reported comes from Tibetan monks who do the so-called tummo, which is the Tibetan word for inner fire. And that's an exercise that is traditionally been done in Tibet in the winter where there's a lot of snow and minus degrees outdoors. And the monks go outside with nothing but wet sheets on their back. So these sheets, under normal circumstances, would freeze very quickly in those temperatures. But instead of getting those sheets frozen on their back, the monks start a meditation, as a result of which their body temperature increases so much that they dry those sheets. It's a bit like a spiritual exercise to increase their mind powers. And it was actually interesting. I always believed that this was possible, but I wasn't quite sure whether you can, you can try it for yourself. I tried it the other day when I read in a book how exactly this is done. And what I read was that you work with your energies, which is not quite the same as visualizing something, but you are going into your own energies. A little bit what we've spoken about last time with Joanna. And you're working with your own inner energies by visualizing, feeling at the same time two central channels that go along your spine roughly. And then you visualize in one of these channels a red and in the other a white tiny ball. One of them begins to move upwards while the other is moving downwards, and then they change direction. And every time when these two balls hit each other, that's when the monks imagine that there is heat producing as a result of that collision. And I can't claim that I dried any sheets, but I tried this exercise as a result of which there was an increase in the body temperature. And I can very well imagine that somebody who becomes fluent at this exercise and practices it for a long time can remarkably increase their body temperature. There is just one step from here, from doing changes in the physiology through the power of your mind, to doing changes in the mind itself. So from the power of the mind to influence the body, it is another step for the mind to influence, to change, and even to heal itself, which is a very interesting thing because it makes consciousness perhaps the only thing in the universe that can change itself from within. And that ability of the mind to change itself has been used in therapy. For example, there is a type of therapy that is called guided affective imagery that is using visual pictures, symbolic visual pictures, to change a person's psyche from within. The interesting thing about that is that when we use images, when we use symbols, then we are talking to the unconscious, or sometimes called the subconscious mind, which bypasses our rational mind. So with using imagery, a therapist can help a client And a client can use his or her own imagery without necessarily needing to be aware of what is going on. So let's say there is a problem that someone has, and they take this problem to a therapist. And that problem might be with their family, with their work, with their self-esteem, with their any kind of psychological issue, really. But the person who goes to a therapist is usually not able to rationally follow up and change that pattern him or herself, too close to it. So in that case, what the therapist uses is a symbolic world, a symbolic landscape. For example, tells the client to go into a relaxed state of mind and then imagine, say, a meadow. And then we can all imagine that the person who says the meadow is green, full of flowers, and the sun is shining has a completely different mental disposition than a person who says it's full of weeds, it's very hard to pass through, and it's raining, or it's foggy. So we can see that immediately the type of imagery that comes up in a relaxed state of mind is somehow symbolic to how the person feels at that moment and how the issues are that he or she is dealing with at the moment. But the really interesting thing begins after that, namely the therapist asks to make changes in the imagery. And then those changes are beginning to affect the real life of that person. For example, the person might suffer under a negative feeling, maybe shame or guilt. And that person is also not able, for whatever reason, to face the issue that is behind that feeling of shame or guilt. But going to a therapist, the therapist who's working with imagery can ask a question like, if that shame or that guilt would be an animal or would be anything, what would it be? So the person comes up with an animal. It comes up with a symbol. And that is something that they can begin working with. The therapist might even ask things like, where in the body is that feeling? Point towards it, describe it. So in a symbolic level, they begin to shape and form that feeling into something that is workable. And then they change that animal, that symbol, whatever picture came up. Interestingly, they never address the issue itself. They just address the symbol. They just address the imagery. Nevertheless, in this type of therapy, there are real results in the real life of the client that are beginning to change. How is that possible? It is imagery that the mind uses to program itself. So we can think of the human mind as a kind of computer, and that computer is working according to the programs that are programmed on it. And there is a sentence in information technology that says garbage in, garbage out, meaning that a computer is just as good as the programs that run it. So if I write a garbage program onto a computer and I put that garbage into it, then I will get garbage result, I will get garbage out. And this is an interesting thing because it's the same way working with the mind. If we use the wrong imagery, if we use wrong programming, then we will get garbage out. If we, for example, have a child who was always discouraged by their parents, has always said things like, don't be so clumsy, don't be so silly, why are you always this, why are you always that, always using negative imagery, then that will become a program that will be implanted in that child's mind and work forever or until it is changed. And the way we change it is to go to that level which the mind uses to program itself deeply. And that level is the level of imagery, of symbols, of internal representations. This method has achieved remarkable successes with very serious things, like, for example, fighting cancer. There is a method called the Simonton method, which is used for fighting cancer from a mental perspective. So patients are encouraged to use imagery over and over again that is symbolizing their immune system fighting the disease. And remarkable results have been accomplished like that. The question is, of course, that interests us most is what kind of using imagery is that produces the greatest results? Do these imageries have to be biologically accurate, medically accurate, or do they have to be in a very deep trance, or what is it that makes such imagery successful? Interestingly, there seem to be one or two things that stand out. One is that using an imagery has to be personal. So there is no right or wrong way to use a picture in the mind, but it has to feel right for the person. So if someone reads in a book that visualization has to be done in this and that way, and the person copies it exactly, that is less likely to be successful than when the person is developing their own way of visualizing something and using what feels right. Interestingly enough, when we say visualization, that is not restricted to visual images. For example, it took me about 10, 15 years of visualization until I realized that I'm not visual at all. And some other people might come to the similar conclusion that a lot of people represent internally things through feelings. They are the so-called kinesthetic people. Or some people represent inner things through auditory impressions. So they always talk to themselves or maybe imagine hearing music or hearing sounds, hearing the voices of other people. So whatever is our inner modality, whatever is our favorite way of representing internally is very personal. And the challenge is to find what feels right for us. So that was one thing that stood out. The other thing that stood out was a observation that some clients didn't heal after using imagery to combat cancer. And when they studied their imagery, they found out that they were very vividly imagining the cancer cells, but they didn't have a clear vision of the immune system. And again, it's not so important. It doesn't seem to be so important that any of that, what they visualize, is medically accurate. But it is important that whatever their imagery is for the immune system has to be at least as strong as their imagery of the disease, or stronger. That seemed to play a very crucial part. So all of these examples seem to suggest that the way we use our mind has its own laws, just like the external world has natural laws. The mind also obeys certain laws, but we haven't explored them as deeply as we have explored the external reality that surrounds us. So the question that arises now, we now know that using the mind has remarkable effects. It can change the body, it can heal diseases, it can dry sheets, meaning it can produce heat, it can change our habits, it can change our psychology. We have a lot of possibilities with working the mind. But how do we really access that? What do we have to do to really be able, at home, on our own, to change our mind so that it works for us and no longer so much against us? Who are the people who can teach us about that? And it's not as easy to find these people as it might sound, because this has never been a leading paradigm in our Western world. So we might want to go and study from the shamans. We might want to go and study from those Tibetan monks or other monks. We might want to study from people who live a spiritual life. And interestingly enough, we might also want to study from the hypnotists who were the predecessors, if you want to put it like that, of modern hypnotherapy. Because many of them are people who know a lot about the mind, even though hypnotism as such always had a bit of a mixed reputation, and therefore it never really made into the mainstream scientific exploration. Hypnosis seems to be as old as humanity, and we certainly find some Egyptian papyrus and some Mesopotamian sources that suggest that even in those earliest times of written history, there has been people who put people into sleep or into a kind of trance and gave them suggestions for healing. And it's been documented that these kind of things have been used. But also, if we just mention the word hypnotism, even in a, you know, a mixed group of people, then probably the reactions to it will be quite mixed as well. Some people will have a strong interest, and some of the people will have a fascination, but maybe something that is more sinister in its nature. I almost never, when I talk to people about hypnosis and hypnotherapy, get a neutral reaction. I get a very charged reaction that sometimes goes into a more frightful and sometimes more into an awesome kind of position, but it's never neutral. I think there are these two extremes. So one of the imagery that people have about hypnotism is something that is portrayed in an old film, The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. It's one of the films that are still silent black and white movies. And in that film, there's this Dr. Caligari, who's a hypnotist, and he's using a subject who he keeps in a coffin-like cabinet and who's in a weird trance every time he brings him on stage. And this somnambulist has the ability, seemingly the ability, to foretell accidents and even people's death. And then the story becomes really sinister because it turns out that this Dr. Caligari is mentally enslaving this somnambulist, and he's actually killing those people. So it becomes a horror film with a weird twist at the end where it turns out that they are all inmates of a lunatic asylum and Dr. Caligari is the director of that. But to cut the long story short, the point is that this is probably still how a lot of people look at hypnotism. That is something very mysterious and something probably potentially abusive and dangerous. But then again, is it always that scary? Because there are other stories that go around as well. One of the positive stories is going back to Rachmaninoff, who composed his first symphony for piano, which turned out to be a failure. And the story of his life says that after his symphony was a failure, he stopped composing altogether. And he fell into a 3-year-long depression. He still continued as a concert pianist, but he wasn't able to compose. He didn't have that confidence that was necessary to bring his work on paper. And we probably would have never had his most famous, his second piano concerto, if it wasn't for a doctor, Nikolai Dahl, who actually, back in those times, applied a early version of hypnotherapy on him. And for a period of 3 months, every day he gave Rachmaninoff the suggestions that he's a great composer and he will compose one of the most beautiful musics that ever has been composed in the history of music. And it turned out to be that which we know today. that these two positions seem to be the extremes of opinions about hypnosis, and they always keep coming back. The sinister version and the great cure for everything version. And we, of course, want to know what is the truth. Can we use it? Is it good or is it sinister? Shall we leave it? Today, modern hypnotherapists seem to say, and this is how I learned it, that a subconscious mind has a filter, and that is filtering out everything that is suggested to it that is not agreeing with. So, for example, it wouldn't work that someone is hypnotizing another person into killing people, like Dr. Caligari did in the movie. So you can't make someone into a killing machine through hypnosis. So that seems to be a very safe way, you know, saying, oh, your subconscious mind has a filter in any way, so it will filter out the good suggestions from the bad suggestions and will only follow the so-called good suggestions. I personally believe that this is a great oversimplification, because if you look at humanity's history, we know that our subconscious mind, or our entire mind altogether, is capable of great evils. And people have been manipulated into doing deeds that are very evil. And some of it might have been not downright hypnosis, but an influence. If we hear a Hitler speaking, that is a type of influencing, a type of hypnotic language that he was using that has been used exactly for evil. So there is historic precedence for that, and we have to learn from it. We have to become careful. I believe here the actual keyword is influence. There is nothing wrong with hypnosis. What is wrong is that it's used by one person to influence the other person. So we don't want to have a scenario where we use hypnotism through one person hypnotizing the other person, one person influencing the other person, one person doing something to the other person. What we want to do is learning hypnotic techniques and use it ourselves. And that is actually the direction where modern hypnotherapy is going. So I'm practicing it myself, and I'm not hypnotizing people into anything. I'm not suggesting them anything that is an influence from me. But what my aim is to teach them, to guide them through an experience that they will be able to use for themselves. And if that is the case, then I believe hypnotic techniques are very good. It's a little bit like with fire. Fire is a good invention if you use it wisely. But of course, it can be deadly if we let it go out of control. But in case of hypnotic techniques, the control has to be the fact that whoever wants to benefit from it learns it from themselves and uses it in a way that the control and the responsibility for the action is inside, not within an external person. And it should be an ethical thing to do anyway. So once we know that this is the way to do and use hypnosis, we can ask the basic question, how does it work? If we want to learn it for ourselves, how does it work? Tune in next time to find the answer. We will be talking about those subtle laws that govern our unconscious mind and that we can use to reprogram it. And we will directly ask questions, how far does the power of our mind go? Today we hear of things like the law of attraction, where we seemingly only need to think of certain things strong enough and long enough to make it reality. But is it really so, or is there something else that we need to know? Stay in, tune in, and we will welcome you back on the next full moon. Thank you for listening.